I wonder if crows are like buses. You wait forever and then two crow stories come along at once. Lynn Bensley has written about the carrion crow and how it was part of his childhood in Haddiscoe. This month he wrote about the crow and an old friend, Barry Mickleborough. And here is Tony Stimpson to read the piece.
During the last white winter a few years ago, I was more than a little curious when a carrion crow began visiting our garden. Several species of gulls and the odd jackdaw made fleeting visits, but I had never seen a carrion crow in the vicinity during the 15 years we had lived in this small market town on the edge of Broadland. Perching in the branches of a large blue cedar, it cautiously weighed up the situation before dropping to feed on a selection of leftovers from Christmas. Hastily devouring its spoils, it returned to the safety of the conifer, where it began to investigate the dense foliage and discovered the remains of a wood pigeon's nest, and evidently made a mental note. Until the snow thawed, the bird returned several times to feed, always exploring the tree further upon each visit, examining every bough and branchlet with all the thoroughness of a feathered super sleuth before disappearing altogether. I thought nothing more of it until the following spring, when the wood pigeons and collared doves had begun to nest, and looking out of the kitchen window one morning, I noticed a carrion crow lurking in the cedar. It soon became apparent that the wily crow had returned to rob the nests of eggs and young and sought to take advantage of a lucrative self-service food source. The wood pigeons usually raised two or three broods each year, while the collared doves were more prolific, raising four or five from early March through to November, and later if mild weather permitted. The canny crow kept up its murderous practice for a year or two, until one gale-force wind too many partially uprooted the shallow-rooted cedar, angling it towards our neighbour's greenhouse and obliging us to have it cut down. Deprived of its easy pickings, the crow stopped visiting, but it was a perfect demonstration of just how uncommonly intelligent the crow and his clan are, and their capacity to learn and remember from experience. Unlike the sociable rook, the carrion crow is a solitary bird, but the two are frequently confused, a problem addressed by the East Anglian adage, "When there's a rook, that's a crow, and when there's crows, that's a rook." When out bird watching in my youth during the 60s, I sometimes used to visit a disused wooden signal box in the middle of the marshes at Haddiscoe, where I lived. It was a desolate, waterlogged wilderness for which I still retain a constant affinity. In the deserted garden attached to the signal box stood a tall, columnar-shaped Victoria plum tree, amid raspberry canes that had run to seed and self-set potatoes. In a landscape of coppiced osiers and stunted hawthorns, it was the only tree of any height upon this region of the marshland levels. A perfect lookout, it became the ancestral home to generations of carrion crows. Often in the company of a couple of friends, I would cycle to the signal box, where we could spend a few hours. From the relative sanctuary of our British rail bird hide, we could observe the crows at close quarters, usually sustained by a packed lunch and a bottle of ginger beer. Swallows had taken up summer residence in the tar-walled plate layer's hut nearby. Mute swans were nesting in Stanton Fleet. Yellow wagtails were feeding their fledglings along Ned's Lane. But our attention was focused for the most part on the pair of carrion crows and their nest of rough sticks and clay which sat in the crown of the plum tree. If at a distance the bird's uniform glossy plumage appears the blackest shade of blackness, up close and personal it is strikingly iridescent, shot through with a mixture of green and purplish sheens. It is a dapper and diverting bird, even if dressed in the garb of an undertaker. Unfortunately, its varied diet includes grain and fruits, the eggs and young of game birds and wildfowl, and it will attack ewes and newborn lambs, and as a consequence, is intensely disliked by farmers, shepherds, and gamekeepers, and for good reason, is said to be the most persecuted bird in the country. I'll concede that their aggressive mannerisms, their skulking attitude, their scavenging habits, and fondness for a rotting carcass, combined with that harsh, rasping call and its heavy black bill, which looks more like a dagger than a beak, wins the bird very few admirers. In history, it has always been a victim of bad press, and was once strongly associated with the gibbet and the gallows pole. It was always known as the harbinger of death, alleged to be in league with the devil, which perhaps explains why the bird retains a baneful reputation. It seems only natural at the time that one of us should climb the tree to examine the nest in which we found four eggs, each coloured an intense greenish-blue and flecked with dark markings. Guilty, I must declare that I collected eggs at the time, and two were taken for myself and a friend. But thankfully the parents did not desert. Egg collecting was then a hobby pursued by many boys like myself, and its adverse effects upon the bird population were never brought into question. Not that either point should be offered in defence of the indefensible. I would, however, like to mitigate my guilt by adding that in my early teens, I worked for the Nature Conservancy Council and played my part in preserving wildlife. One of the bird-watching chums on those excursions to the isolated signal box was Barry Mickleborough, who lived in an equally remote railway cottage half a mile away and who gradually began to develop an obsession with crows. As a child, he had first begun to observe the crows that nested in a grove of willow trees outside his bedroom window. When workers were contracted to clear the trees, Barry rescued the one surviving fledgling from a crow's nest among the debris. He reared the chick and kept it for 8 or 9 months, training the bird to sit upon his shoulder as he worked in the garden, before it suddenly flew off one day, never to return. I would not say it was ever a particularly friendly, but it was not menacing, though I was always aware that it could peck an eye out if it so wished. But it could be comical. It was very clever. It could exhibit a plethora of human-like expressions. It was all-knowing. Rearing the young crow had cemented Barry's allegiance to the corvid family, and huddled in an army sleeping bag, he would spend hours on the marshes studying and sketching the birds as they conducted their mysterious rituals, undisturbed by his presence. I was fascinated by Ted Hughes's crow poems and how he captured certain elements of their dark character. Leaving school, he took up carpentry, but following an accident was forced to give up his trade and took a degree in fine art. Oils became his medium, and rooks and crows became the dominant theme. He exhibited his work throughout Europe, America, and Japan before he became disillusioned and exchanged his paintbrush in favour of the chisel. At dusk time, crows come into their own. As the mist rises from the boggy swamps, where you are likely to drown if you stray off the footpaths, you hear them calling across the marshes. They have an instinct for survival, and I respect crows more than any other bird, he said.
Thank you, Tony.